Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 22nd of September 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We're going to be joined by live video Skype link by Mark Anderson from American Free Press, and also John Devine, who's going to be bringing in some very important information about abuse of children. Well, the sun is shining, Mike.
Is it?
Apparently.
Right.
It is just in Plymouth, and we've got a few reports of warmth and sunshine in central Scotland, so things not looking too bad across UK today.
I suppose before we begin, we should thank everybody that came to the meeting last night.
Indeed, very successful UK Column Plymouth meeting, and of course there was a group of people that had travelled all the way from London, so 8-hour return, a round trip. Thank you very much for coming down to see us, and we really do hope we'll see you again, and also at the British Constitution Group conference on the 19th of November. And before I forget it, I have a pair of glasses, spectacles, that somebody left at that meeting. They've got a little piece of tape over one of the hinges. So if you've lost a pair of glasses, put in a email request to UK Column and we'll see what we can do.
Okay, let's get straight into some heavy subjects here. And we're going to start off with Truth and Reconciliation in Canada. John Devine from Canada, and we're going to be speaking quite a bit about the kind of things that have been going on in Canada recently over the last few decades, I suppose. Now, Mark Anderson's just pointed out to me that this particular slide here is from the original National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation, and that original investigation, or whatever it was, has been moved into the University of Manitoba now. So, John, this is clearly related to abuse of children, and particularly Indigenous children. Give us a bit of background to what this is about.
Well, our newly elected federal government, Prime Minister Trudeau, shortly after getting into power, announced that they would be honoring the 94 issues addressed in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission regarding abuse to Indigenous people. And, of course, some of that abuse had to do with the children in the orphanages involving thousands of children. So, you know, we collectively as a society, through the democratic process, have said, okay, we're going to compensate for that. That's fine. That's where it's supposed to go with democracy. But the problem we have is the abuses haven't stopped. And it seems to me, if you look at the past, your question's got to be asked, how much enabling was going on? And of course, that question probably will never be answered. But whether it be in your country or our country, you've got to figure over the length of time that abuses were going on, that somebody was trying to blow the whistle and somebody wasn't listening. Now, that takes you to our current situation up here. We've been involved in whistleblowing for numerous issues. And the Indigenous one came upon us, too, under the roof of Casino Rama, and the corruption under the roof sponsored by the Ontario Ministry of Labour. Now, it gets a little deeper in that, but if we wanted to just step back and take a look about, I asked the question to ensure us that there is no more debt being created because of the sins, somebody should reply to us and explain what our concerns are, and they're not legal. If they're not legal, that's fine. Let's proceed with legal action. But silence is not an answer anymore.
So where is this this whole issue at? We've got an article here from Think Progress saying the Canadian government systematically tortured and abused Aboriginal children for 100 years. And I suppose, this is something that Kevin Annett has been trying to expose for many years now. But is there progress being made to deal with this issue?
Well, in the legal side of it, we haven't heard of any criminal charges recently being laid. I know the Catholic Church, there were some, the United Church, I haven't heard of any. So, you know, I guess what they're trying to say is we'll compensate by money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and forego the chance of getting a conviction. So, it's kind of out there. We hope that something's going to happen quickly to the victims. There will be financial compensation, but no report card has come back yet as to where we're at with that.
And is there a wide acknowledgement that this headline here suggesting that the Canadian government is involved to some degree, but is there a wide acknowledgement that government politicians perhaps are directly involved?
Well, I guess the problem in Canada, our media is, you know, they become the enablers. I have documentation to prove that. And so what the people of Canada think they understand isn't really what's going on. But if anybody were to take time and look at that Kevin Annette documentary, you would soon change your mind.
Yes.
John, I'll just add to that in UK at the moment, there is individual after individual coming forward and claiming that they were abused. Some of this is many years ago, some of it is very current. But you've talked about the silence, and this is the chief weapon, certainly, that the British government is using at the moment, that whenever victims come forward and talk about what's happened to them, there is simply a wall of silence from the government, and indeed the very agencies that say they are there to protect children. And that wall of silence certainly includes the Church of England. There's one key case that we have reported over recent days, and that is the Kendall House children's home in Kent, where young girls were drugged unconscious and abused. And even when the church was faced with their records from that home, which included detailed medical records showing excessive and dangerous levels of drugs administered, what did the Church of England do? It used a very powerful legal team to, first of all, attempt to put a wall up and deny. So the silence does seem to be one of the first barriers that any of the investigations into this large-scale child abuse have to get through.
Well, you see, we experienced that here with our new Prime Minister. When he was leader of the opposition a year before being elected, we mailed him all the details, my diary of abuses put upon Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, and he didn't reply. He just stayed quiet. At that time, you would have thought they would have thrown that into the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to get current, to clean up the mess, but instead they left ours out there and thought they would tidy up the past up to but not including what we're reporting in regards to abuses.
Yeah. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, just to clarify that some 50,000 Indigenous kids, mostly from the tribal communities, died or were severely abused. And outside these residential schools, they actually found children buried in the ground that had been killed through electroshock, drugging, extreme neglect, starvation, and things like that. So the severity of it is something we can't overlook. And John makes a great point. They just want to basically pay money out. And this reminds me of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, which a lot of critics call the hush money fund. In other words, pay people off for the past abuses, don't really have convictions or justice in terms of people going to prison, just buy people's silence and sweep it under the rug, and then a lot of the problems are left unsolved, justice is not achieved, and the can gets kicked down the road and gets kicked down the road more. The debt and the crime just continues to get excused and passed down into the future.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Well, one of the other subjects that, John, that you're reporting on is utilities in Canada. Now, you have here a document titled "The Referendum Vote by the People Must Stand." Give us a bit of background to this.
Okay, our local utility, Rea Water, Light and Power, recently was sold to Hydro One, the distribution sector, not the generation sector. But this whole thing, we have a history in this, our municipal government, of meetings behind closed doors, and this one went behind closed doors, and they came out and said we've sold the distribution part for $26 million. But I hear calls from people who have a lot of knowledge about what was going on inside of Rea Water, Light and Power, that being former commissioners, and they were saying that there's $56 million invested for materials to build the distribution line. So we've taken quite a hit. So I guess what I'm saying is, one more time, it's a silence and a in the clouds that cause suspicion. If they were to disclose what were the details of the sale, we might be quite comfortable with what they've got to tell us. But to get the details, they say you've got to file the Freedoms of Information Act. So it's that whole wall of silence again in regards to utilities. And, of course, that utility thing, there's a bigger picture here. Mark can probably allude to that a little better. But I ask the question, if Hydro One's gone private, Hydro One buys our local distribution lines, could they not turn around and flip it for a profit to some consortium in the world? Yeah. You know, these are all the questions we were asking, but we can't get any answers.
Yes, probably the Chinese, in fact. And but, I mean, we've only started this program. We're 10 minutes in, and really this is the first time in quite a while that we've spoken to you, John. But clearly the policy agenda at work in Canada is pretty much identical to the policy agenda at work in the UK and the United States.
Well, you know, I don't know whether your media is quite as questionable as ours, because here's a classic example. Post Media has a CEO's name is Paul Godfrey. They're one of five major players in Canada. Anyways, Paul Godfrey, while he's occupying the position of CEO of Post Media, gets appointed to the chair of the OLG, Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation. And there's always a lot of money flowing from the gaming corporation to advertising lottery tickets. So you're just concerned about the conflict to start with. But under Godfrey's watch, when he's chair of the OLG, they laid off all the nurses under the roof of Casino Rama. In those particular years, they were making probably well over $300 million a year. And when they laid off all the nurses, they downloaded onto the hospital here. So I don't know whether you guys have got a media where they can actually get involved in downloading on a hospital. Like, there's a whole, several different hats being worn here by Mr. Godfrey. Yeah. After I complained to Premier Wynne about Godfrey's conflict, they fired him about a month later, but they didn't. Nobody replied to me.
Yeah. Well, there's that famous saying that dirty deeds are done in the dark, and I think that's very appropriate for these sorts of deals. Here in UK, we've seen unlimited public infrastructure. The public has paid for the development and the build and the installation of that infrastructure. And then in a closed-door deal, as you describe, that infrastructure has been sold off. We've got, for example, Electricité de France has come in and taken up a huge chunk of our electricity market. We've got the Chinese coming in to take on nuclear infrastructure. None of this has been debated properly. The public certainly haven't been asked. And now we're selling off water again, so that basically this most vital asset is going to be put in the hands of commercial companies. It's the same pattern wherever you look. It's happening in the States. It's happening, you're describing, in Canada, and it's happening in UK. It all comes back to the power of corporate interests who are driving this. It seems to me, with the collaboration of the public sector, which should be protecting us.
Well, absolutely. There's all kinds of players at the table that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's just move on to really the state of British politics. And what better man to bring on screen than former Conservative Member of Parliament Brooks Newmark? So the Daily Mail here taking off with the headline, "The shamed Tory MP and the selfie wants to ban you from seeing. Sexting ex-minister asks solicitors to have topless image deleted." Now, we say what's going on here is this is yet another example of establishment figures using their wealth and power to manipulate wider media to protect themselves from public scrutiny. And of course, here's Brooks Newmark. We understand that he's studying at Oxford University, as befits this sort of man.
Why is he an MP?
There hangs a question. We don't really know what he's doing. But I just wanted to point out that, of course, he's looking proper here. He's in his suit and tie. And this is the image he would like to give the public. And the image he doesn't really like is this one. And this is one of the more mild images, because the one of him standing in front of a toilet is even more impressive. And, oh dear, he's upset. "My political career is in ruins. I've traumatised my family and let down my constituents and my colleagues. Many will regard me as a failure. I can possibly manage why. imagine why. And it's true. Behind the outward facade of success and achievement, I have been battling demons and losing to them. So here he is now. He got involved with the sexy stuff, got caught out, made a complete fool of himself. But now we've got to modify the whole of the World Wide Web so that we can't know what sort of man Brooks Newmark really is. And he is an utterly vile man. Why do I say that with perhaps that emphasis? Well, let's take ourselves back to 2013, when here is the same Brooks Newmark. I'm glad to say he's actually got some clothes on in this picture. He was having tea with Assad, treating him as a friend, and then he came back to UK and wrote an utterly vile article in which he said, "I know Assad, and I know it's time to arm the Syrian rebels and bring him down," says Brooks Newmark, who visited the dictator's house for tea. Now, the rebels he's talking about are people cutting off the heads of 12-year-old boys. But if we get into the text, let's have a look at this. He said, "This is not Iraq. In Iraq, there were no chemical weapons. In Syria, we know for sure Assad has used them. We sent thousands of British troops to Iraq. No one is suggesting sending a single British soldier to Syria." So the first part of this is that the chemical weapons were used, but then he said no troops. Let's just remind ourselves of what the British press has been saying in recent days. They have the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, so a government committee, has basically said that David Cameron's complete failure in Libya spread Gaddafi regime weapons across the region and assisted the growth of Islamic State terrorists. So we've got a politician who actually is pretty mucky sitting down with Assad, and he's the one he is blaming for chemical weapons. Well, we challenged Brooks Newmark on this. We sent him an email and we said, "Thank you for speaking to us." I'm not sure whether he did enjoy speaking to me, but basically he maintained on the phone that chemical weapons had been used, and I pointed out to him that in all the documentation to date, what it actually said is that basically the use of the chemical weapons was only alleged. Now, Mr. Newmark, when he found the conversation difficult, he couldn't come up with any fast evidence. We finished the phone conversation. But so that people can catch up with these events, really, at the time, these were the sorts of reports coming out, London and Paris and the United Nations. They were talking about new levels of brutality. But this was also the language they were using. It says that Paulo Pinheiro, who chairs the UN Commission, said, quote, "It had not been possible, on the evidence available, to determine the precise chemical agents used, their delivery systems, or the perpetrator." And yet we had this despicable MP, used to be a Lehman banker, of course. I think they went bust, Mike.
They did, yeah.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, that's a shame. But basically, he said that the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office had confirmed that the Assad regime had used chemical weapons. We said, "Who gave you that information?" Of course, Brooks Newmark refused to say. I'm just going to close by saying here that isn't it wonderful that we've got people like Vanessa Bealey, who is brave enough to get in on the ground in Syria to get the truth out. But I'll pass over to you, Mark. We have British politicians. I mean, this is breathtaking arrogance. Equivalent, I think, of Hillary Clinton, from what I'm seeing at the moment, with "I did not send a single classified email." It's outrageous. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. That broad panorama that you guys just covered with David Cameron, those weapons that were taken out of the Gaddafi regime in Libya were funneled through Turkey into Syria. And then all these factions that we're told are these separate terrorist factions, which are really more unified than we're told, that are trying to overthrow Syria. Those weapons came in part out of Libya, and Hillary Clinton is thought to have had involvement in that weapons transfer through Benghazi. And her emails may even reveal that, except, oops, she deleted a lot of them. So this is a huge issue. I concur. Brooks Newmark would have definitely found that conversation difficult because there never was any concrete proof that the Syrian leader gassed his own people with chemical weapons. It just was never proven. It was a hoax or exaggerated at the very least to try and justify a war back then, a full-scale attack, and now they're just using ISIS and these proxies, Mossad, MI6, CIA proxies, these terrorist factions. They're just using that as a battering ram to go after Assad through the back door.
Right, Mark, can I just one quick point add there is that Mr. Newmark has said publicly that he is Jewish, and he also says that he abhors Assad for his stance against Israel. So we come back to another critical point here. When we see Brooks Newmark, whether he's got clothes on or not, we don't know whether he's actually pushing policy which has actually come out of the British government for the benefit of the British nation, or in fact he's running a side policy which is to the benefit of Israel.
Well, that's a very good point, because of course it was never acknowledged by anybody or ever divulged by anybody publicly whether that back channel that Brooks Newmark had set up between himself and the Free Syrian Army, because of course the closest he got to Syria was the Turkish border, but it was never divulged whether that back channel was an officially sanctioned back channel or not. So was he there representing the British government, or was he there representing the Israeli government? We have no way of knowing. But the other, just before we move on to Syria again, the other thing I would say about this, Brian, of course, is the pressure is starting to come back on over Leveson, and Leveson 2 is in the wings. And so the timing of this
is interesting
that as well. Now,
sorry, just for Mark and John, probably just so that you're clear, Leveson, of course, is the barrister that was brought in effectively to try and get government control of the media. So what we are saying is there's going to be another attempt within UK for draconian legislation to make sure that you cannot get the truth out.
Now, on Syria then, Mark, you wanted to highlight this article, Why the US Had to Kill the Syrian Ceasefire, and this is from Finian Cunningham.
Yes. Also, Richard Walker, an American Free Press correspondent, has hit this story in our edition that's coming out soon. It's going to press later today. And that, in a nutshell, is that the U.S. hit a Syrian military base and killed dozens of people very recently during what was supposed to be a ceasefire. It basically ended or sabotaged the ceasefire and actually gave our so-called enemies, ISIS, a leg up. And people can read about it more through American Free Press and through this article you're posting now, Mike. It shows who the real friends are in this ceasefire, and that is not the U.S.
Indeed. Well, on the same subject then, this is something that we, and particularly Vanessa Bailey, have been highlighting for quite some time. Because, of course, Arar al-Sham are one of the moderate, so-called moderate rebel groups that we are supporting directly, whereas we don't admit to directly supporting ISIS. But, of course, one of the points that Vanessa has been making strongly is that Arar al-Sham are as bad, if not worse, than ISIS themselves. And what this article is pointing out, we mentioned this when Vanessa was on the program on Monday, that Turkey has annexed effectively a part of northern Syria to the west of the Euphrates. Of course, we mentioned the fact that, the word annexed isn't really being used in the mainstream press, but when allegations of annexation happen in other parts of the world, of course, that's justification for serious attacks on their credibility as a nation. Turkey isn't receiving the same type of public denunciation. But anyway, in this case, this article is reporting is that Arar al-Sham has joined Turkey in the north of Syria. This is a terrorist organization. These people are cutting the heads off children. But they are our friends, and they're joining this this Turkish coalition, including the FSA in the north of Syria, in this annexed 900 square kilometer area, whatever that is in miles. This is a dangerous development. So we will keep an eye on this and report more in due course. But Turkey absolutely in bed with these, clearly in bed with these terrorist organizations, as are we. Now, Yemen continues to be a problem. Of course, this is the war that nobody in the mainstream press really wants to report. But Saudi Arabia continues to bomb Yemen. And this report from France 24 saying that they've killed 20 civilians in the latest attacks on a Yemeni port. Saudi airstrike on the rebel-held, the so-called rebel-held Yemeni port of Hodeida late on Wednesday, just hours after the rebels, in inverted commas, celebrated the second anniversary of their seizure of the capital. Now, this Foreign Office has made a statement on this and on the situation in Yemen in general. And what they're saying is that they had held two meetings with foreign ministers from the UK, USA, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. We apparently met with these people in April and again in July, but we've just issued this communique, which says the foreign ministers expressed their full support for the special envoy to Yemen and his proposed roadmap to reach a comprehensive agreement, which is based on the Gulf Cooperation Council initiative and its implementation mechanisms, UN security resolutions and statements, including Resolution 2216. We've got to remember that what's at work here is the attempted installation of a Western-backed regime in Yemen, which the Yemeni people don't support. UN Security Council resolution, as we've mentioned before, is bogus. The statement went on to say, to avoid further humanitarian suffering and economic deterioration, the foreign ministers further called on all parties to allow safe, rapid and unhindered access for humanitarian supplies. And the hypocrisy here is absolutely unbelievable, because, of course, the one thing which would avoid further humanitarian suffering would be to stop bombing civilians and stop bombing anybody, in fact. And the fact that Saudi Arabia was involved in these meetings and Saudi Arabia's name is on this communique is really pretty despicable. Which brings me to this, because this article in Pacific Standard asking, will the civilian deaths in Yemen force a reset on US-Saudi relations? And they're saying a new report finds that more than one third of air raids in Yemen conducted by Saudi Arabia have destroyed civilian institutions, while American politicians decry the long, costly conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. America and its allies are losing another battle in the war on terror. A new report based on data analysed by the Yemen Data Project reveals more than one third of air raids on Yemen conducted by Saudi Arabia have destroyed infrastructure, including medical and educational facilities. You know, as I say, the hypocrisy absolutely tangible here, because on one hand, we allege that the Russians and the Syrians are bombing medical and educational facilities in Syria, and that's really bad. On the other hand, we're sitting down with Saudi Arabia, who are doing exactly the same thing, and then issuing communiques saying that, we hope all this trouble will stop and we're going to stick in some humanitarian aid. And of course, we know what comes with the humanitarian aid. That's the NGOs and the organizations that are actually helping break down the country. And just to end this section, just remind everybody about this JASTA legislation. 9/11 families protesting outside the White House, because this is linked due to the fact that the families are particularly interested in suing Saudi Arabia for their part in what happened on 9/11. Obama is vetoing this bill passing. The Senate saying that they will override Obama's veto, that they have enough votes to do that. But Mark, what are your thoughts on what we've just been covering there?
Well, that's a lot, Mike. I would add, touching on the last item, that it's really a major misdirection to get everyone thinking, well, Saudi Arabia is partially or solely responsible for the events of 9/11.
No, I appreciate that. But of course, the key point here is that they had some involvement, and you know, Saudi Arabia should be a target for criticism at the minute, bearing in mind what they're doing in Yemen. So you know, we should be encouraging the families in this pursuit, at least.
Yes, I mean, in that sense, I would concur that, given what they're doing in Yemen and the hypocrisy you pointed out, it's fine for these things to happen in Syria. Oh, that's just the, you know, the tactics of warfare and propaganda. But we can act like we're humanitarians when it comes to, we can ignore what's going on, what the Saudis are doing bombing Yemen, you know, having that dichotomy you spoke of. And yeah, if the 9/11 thing can be a way of getting at the Saudis for their duplicity and for their bombardment of Yemen, then it would have a silver lining. But the idea that the Saudis were very heavily involved, if involved at all, in 9/11 itself, of course, is a very flimsy theory that we'll leave for another day. But it does provide a way to pry open the Saudi enigma and get at them, at least start the conversation what they're doing in Yemen, which is very deplorable, of course.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's a lot to sort out there. But, yeah, that's an important sort of backdoor way of opening that argument.
Can we ask John, is there are the Canadian public aware of these events? What's the mood in Canada about actions in Yemen?
Well, we our federal government sponsors the CBC for the tune of $1 billion a year, and we get a lot of international news. But where I sit, I get skeptical of a lot of it because I see the reality of the media being manipulated all the time. So, and then of course the Canadians get a lot of CNN, and if you want to find out about Donald Trump, go there. So yeah, I guess we're educated about what's going on, but I really don't think we know the facts of all of it. My personal observation is it is so tribal over there that we like to define things by boundaries, and I don't think it's ever been like that and ever will be like that. It's tribe, but it's a dog's breakfast.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description. Well, interesting to see that what's happening in UK is that the servicemen and women who are put in to the field to carry out these corporate wars are then being attacked by their own government. And some of this is really becoming very obvious. The Telegraph here with this, that British soldiers face a new wave of criminal investigations. And local Plymouth Conservative MP Johnny Mercer, who's ex-army himself, says, "I cannot envisage a more scrutinised battlefield we've asked our soldiers to operate on than Afghanistan." So we expect these people to go out and fight in very difficult circumstances. At the beginning of the conflict, at least, they didn't have the right equipment and gear. They were put in very dangerous positions. They are killed, they're maimed through IEDs. And now the British government is helping to support organisations, one of them being Red Snapper that we've talked about recently, to recruit legal teams in order to help prosecute these very brave men and women. We might not agree with the wars. We don't agree with the wars. But what we are pointing out is that people who risk their lives on the battlefield are then being attacked by the British government. And of course, we still have Sergeant Alexander Blackman, Royal Marine. He is still in prison, having been convicted of killing a wounded Taliban on the field. So apparently no account taken of the situation overall and the battlefield stress. So we've got the situation where we say, well, we can't recruit for the armed forces. I think part of that is clearly because the young people are smart enough to know they're not going to put their lives on the line if their own government is then going to stab them in the back with legal action. But it's not only legal action being used. Have a look at this one. This was a report from a while ago where the Independent took the lead on warning about the dangers to British Armed Forces, people who were given the anti-malarial drug Larium. Now, the interesting factor is this drug was banned by American forces. They said it was dangerous, so the Americans are not giving it to any military personnel. Well, many people in UK have been campaigning to be stopped here, but of course the Ministry of Defence not listening. but some amazing statistics just out. And as of 10 o'clock this morning, it was only the UK column that was talking about these statistics. So this is the report. And basically, what are they saying? Well, they're saying that 6.9% of those prescribed with Larium subsequently had an initial assessment for a mental health disorder, and 7.9% of those prescribed other drugs had an assessment for mental health disorder. Now, the report said this: it's not possible from centrally held data to identify whether the mental health episode was associated with being prescribed an anti-malarial drug. That is a fair statement, because the people who produce the statistics are not medically qualified to make that connection. But let's use a little bit of common sense from their own statistics. So we've got one of the graphs here. So this is talking about Larium. And just have a look at the numbers of people we're talking about. 1,200 servicemen and women showing mental health problems after this drug is prescribed. The top line numbers of personnel in each year that have been given the drug. The bottom red line is those having to have some form of mental health assessment. And there's, to me, a clear correlation in those two lines. Let's bring in the larger sample of the other drug, which was given to 99,000 troops. We're now talking about 7,800 troops having problems with mental health issues. So that's a total number there of whatever it is, 9,000. We're talking about 8% suffering problems out of the individuals given this drug. If this was to be a casualty on the battlefield, this would be untenable. 9,000 British casualties, not as a result of action of an enemy in Afghanistan or Libya or Syria even. This is the result of a British government pushing out a dangerous medication on British forces. And of course, they have to accept that medication. We spoke to the MOD media team this morning. I'm going to say they were polite, but I thought a little bit jittery. They said the line is that there's no proven medical relationship between Larium and other anti-malarial drugs and mental health problems. But they've promised to come back to us with a proper emailed statement in due course.
A couple of weeks ago, and I can't remember which senior military general it was, but I believe it was a general, made a public statement about Larium and criticised it strongly. The Minister of Defence at the time said, well, it's okay because we've mostly got people off Larium and onto other drugs now. But the word mostly stood out, because if even top military brass are saying we should not be using this, and the MOD is saying, well, we're mostly not using it, what that implies is that they've got a stockpile of the drug sitting there, and they are determined to use it and not throw it in the bin.
That's exactly correct, Mike. And we also know a representative from the company that makes Larium met with senior military officers and MOD officials. And in that meeting, the company said quite correctly that the Ministry of Defence was not prescribing Larium in accordance with the guidelines stated on each and every packet. So we might not agree with the drug industry or what it's doing, but if we take pure factual information here, we know that the Ministry of Defence was not prescribing this drug properly. What do? They switch to other drugs, which by these statistics appear even more dangerous. And what are we talking about? We're talking about men and women with access to small arms, to munitions, explosives, very, very dangerous weapons. And of course, people with mental illness are not exactly prime candidates to be in the military. Mark, this has been a big issue for veterans in the States, that there's been a strong push by the those who want to get guns away from the American public to make sure that any ex-military people are screened for mental illness. And if there's the slightest whisper of it, they're not going to be entitled to a weapon. There's something very fishy going on here, I think.
Oh, indeed, Brian. That's true what you said. The mental illness thing is a gateway. If you don't pass the muster, you can have your Second Amendment rights suspended or abolished. But it also goes back to the Gulf War syndrome becoming finally acknowledged by the U.S. government as Gulf War illness. And U.S. soldiers were used as guinea pigs during the earlier days of the War on Terror. They were given different vaccines, many of which were not fully tested to see if they were safe. They were exposed to insecticides to keep the desert fleas away. They were exposed to oil well fires, depleted uranium, radioactive fallout from the munitions that the U.S. uses that are tipped with depleted uranium to penetrate armor, and so on and so forth. And so just like in Britain, the number of casualties and deaths in America from the War on Terror in all the theaters is much, much higher than the official killed in action counts that were given. So it's critical to take note that the real War on Terror has probably taken 100,000 American lives, conservatively speaking, at least 90,000, and we're told figures like Afghanistan, 4,000 or 5,000, Iraq, 5,000 or 6,000. So these are vastly underreported, vastly suppressed numbers from suicides and from disease and non-battle injury, because all they give us is killed in action figures. And so we are not being told the real toll, we are not being told the real death toll of the War on Terror.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm just going to put this slide up because this is the reality of it. We've now got a British Prime Minister, Theresa May. I'm calling her the Jezebel Prime Minister. Seems that the characteristics of Jezebel fit perfectly. But she's leading a government attacking her own people. We can see it with children, the sexualization of children. We've got the breakup of families. We've got even the attack on what our gender is. Industry destroyed, the health service destroyed, morality. And here we're seeing yet another facet of this where they are prepared from the inside to help destroy Britain's own military while using those brave men and women to fight their wars overseas. Now, before I hand back to Mike, I just would like to mention, having mentioned Theresa May as a Conservative, we better bring in the Labour Party. And here they are, the Miliband brothers. David Miliband Wright quit UK politics. I should have labelled this. This is a Daily Mail article here. Should have quit UK politics after feuding with his brother Ed. They look similar to Muppets. I'm very happy to say that. Of course, Muppets, I think, invented in America.
Yes.
Well, we've sent a couple back to you. So here he is, the president of the International Rescue Committee claimed Labour had slipped from a party fit for government to a secondary influence on national decision making. He said, we've not been further from power since the 1930s. UK Column would just like to remind viewers and listeners that David Miliband deserted UK for the USA and a Soros-backed International Rescue Committee. So sheer hypocrisy from a couple of Muppets. But we thought we'd just mention them to lighten the programme a bit.
Well, we should also just mention, Mark, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there has been a rumour that should Hillary become president, that David Miliband would leave his job with the International Rescue Committee and take US citizenship and end up working as part of her cabinet.
My Lord, I thought the horrors were finally going to cease for a little bit. That almost defies comment, except to say that I think he needs to go see a shrink, and if he doesn't have one, he better get one soon. Hillary, speaking of the Jezebel syndrome, Hillary and Theresa May are cut from the same cloth. So if he wants to keep that kind of company, I won't get in the way of his insanity. He'll just have to be his own undoing.
Right. Look, we're really short for time, so we're just going to have to rush through this. Mark, if you don't mind. Now, we mentioned this Chicago Council of Global Affairs and the fact that the Mayor of London had visited that last week. Now, you watched this speech and you had a couple of comments to make on that. And you also mentioned the fact that the Chicago Council of Global Affairs has added some content to their website, which perhaps gives us a clue as to what George Osborne might be up to next.
I mainly looked, Mike, at Sadiq Khan, your mayor. I guess he's your first Muslim mayor of Muslim extraction. His parents were born in a Muslim country. He was evidently born in the UK. What he did is he spoke recently in his first stop in the U.S., and that was at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Now, that's the former Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, which is tied to the New York Council on Foreign Relations, which is a sibling of Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. There's a direct connection by way of how I describe. And so Sadiq Khan shows up. He speaks to the CCGA very recently, about mid-September. And the global cities thing is going forward. And there's two basic things. Real quick, he emphasized how the cities, the global cities, that consider themselves part of a worldwide network, need to have the U.S. and the nation states being pulled from behind. In other words, dragging the nation states along as the cities take the lead in addressing climate change, as the cities take the lead in social integration of a very comprehensive nature. So clearly, the cities see themselves as the vanguard of the rest of the worldwide federation that they want to put together. They're not in the back, they're in the front. And the only other thing I'll mention is that he describes social integration as not being assimilation. So in other words, we are no longer living in a world, according to people like Sadiq Khan, where when in Rome, you do as the Romans do. Every country is supposed to be this hodgepodge of all these different cultures. And the way he's describing this social integration is no one country would have any distinct identity anymore. So one country would be like another, would be like another, much in the way that you go from town to town in the American states, and every town looks the same because they all have the same chain stores and chain restaurants and Walmart supercenters. All the distinction and personality of each town is almost gone. So as from below, so as above, they're doing it this way, and Sadiq Khan explained this. I guess he did us a service in the sense that he was very candid. And he says things like English should be the common language, which maybe is a good thing so everyone can communicate. But the bottom line is that the cities are the vanguard in the rest of the globalization movement, and this social integration he's talking about has a lot of very worrisome aspects of it, because any real democratic expression is considered populism. If it's populism, it's considered radicalism. If it's radicalism, it's would-be terrorism. And so therefore, if you want real democratic expression, you're on the road to terrorism. You're on the road to being a terrorist yourself, on the road to perdition. So it's a very mixed bag, and people need to look closer at what the London mayor is saying.
Absolutely, you're bang on there, and of course, this is what the diversity agenda is about. What diversity training is about: people are being trained not to actually recognize and appreciate other people's cultures, other people's differences. What they're doing is trying to merge people together, and they're destroying other cultures and other differences. And the language thing, Mark, is a key. This is a key point. If we really want diversity and diversification within the human species, if you want to put it that way, we need diverse languages, because, as Alex Thompson will tell us, concepts that are expressed in one language cannot be expressed in another language, and therefore different peoples approach different problems from different directions. And this is something that if you're only an English speaker and you don't really appreciate another language, then you can't really understand the approach that they're taking to solve a problem. So in fact, what we end up with, just as with our high streets, is a mush of nothingness and actually a reduction in our capability to develop as humans.
How much time we have left, but just to put a cap on what you're saying, Mike, yeah, I mean, people can speak their native languages in their home, and maybe there's some merit to having English in the business world. But the problem with this is that you could have an organic nation like Switzerland that has different languages and regions, and it works because it more or less grew up organically. But what they're talking about here with the London mayor is a forced integration under the guise of an organic development. They're trying to make it look organic, but it's a forcible integration. Yeah. Normal integration organically is fine in a lot of ways, but when you try and make it forced and coercion is involved at whatever level, that's the problem. And he's anti-Brexit, of course, and a lot of anti-Brexit comments were made at the Chicago group, also anti-Trump comments. So they're very anti-populist. They don't want genuine democratic expression. They want contrived democracy. And in this social integration, that's their model.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mark. Right. Look, we are out of time. So just before we go, John, you've just launched a new newspaper here called the Awakening newspaper. Awakening, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. The Awakening News. And we our second edition, and we're trying to get the city, the people inside the city to listen up to some of the issues that are really going to affect our future economically. There's several issues at play right now in the casino that could be a result of losing 500-600 jobs. We've also tried to address our water issue. That's where we started from. We've got some information that any government running a fish hatchery should be made aware of. Example, New York State has just announced they're spending some serious grant money on infrastructure and fish hatcheries and spending money to find more groundwater when we've got proven technology. They don't need to go that route. Spend the money on infrastructure to rebuild, to build or retool an existing flow-through system in a fish hatchery and save yourself trillions of gallons of clean groundwater. Anyways, we're still pounding the table on that one. And just one other quick one about the drug issue in regards to the military. Well, that's just one of a massive problem of our drug industry trying to find solutions and instead creating problems of addiction. You know, our society 30 years ago never had addictions like they have today caused by prescribed drugs. And another new opiate is gambling.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
All right. Mark and John, thank you very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of today's news. I'll just say thank you again to those people that travelled not only from London, but as far afield as the Isle of Wight to visit us yesterday. Very good meeting. We thoroughly enjoyed it. Put that date in your diary, the 19th of November, for the British Constitution Group, looking at law, reasserting the rule of law in UK. It's pretty obvious to us now that we are a lawless state governed by a criminal government. So recognising that is more than half the way to addressing the problem. So do join us in November if you can. Thanks for joining us today. If you're not a subscriber, please consider subscribing to UK Column. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.